Okay, everyone. All right. Well, thank you so much, Leonard and Barbara, for being here today. And we are so thankful that you came and are going to be presenting to our library community. Leonard David is an award-winning space journalist reporting on space activities for over 50 years. He is also the author of 3 National Geographic books on space exploration, which of course we have at the library and you can also purchase off Amazon. Moonrush, The New Space Race, Mars, Our Future on the Red Planet. And he also co-authored with Apollo 11 astronaut, somebody you might have heard of, Buzz Aldrin, Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration. And the first person to type in the chat box where the Apollo 11 landed on the moon gets themselves a $10 gift certificate to Salto. So get typing. He also has his own website, which is Leonard David's Inside Outer Space, www.leonarddavid.com. He's much more imaginative than his URL would like you to believe. And Leonard and his wife, Barbara, and John Williams are the organizers of Coal Creek Canyon Sky Watchers Astronomy Group, which currently meets monthly via Zoom. And if you would like to be added to their email list, all the information is here in the chat box. As we've mentioned, Ben, you got the year. Where did they land? Where? Sea of what? Not my personality. Sea of what?
I'd be tranquil.
There we go. Leonard. You won. Anyway, so we're going to get started. We are recording. And so again, we ask that everybody put your questions in the chat box, and then we'll make sure that we get to all of them. Is there anything I have forgotten, Barbara? If you don't know, you can minimize your view so that you just see the presentation full screen. Anything else that I may have forgotten to mention?
I think you got it.
That's it. And don't take it personally, but I have the power to mute you all, including myself, and I shall do so now. Okay, take it away, please, Leonard.
Okay, well, if everybody hears me, I appreciate it, and thanks for linking up on this. It's, you know, kind of an odd thing. You know, I sit here and pretty much every day go through dozens and dozens and dozens of press releases about space, and I am myself surprised of how much is going on. It is becoming a huge, kind of a event. But it's, you know, my long-term interest in space, I've never been so pleased with how much is happening. I feel like a kid again, and I need that as I get older. You got to go back to where you began, and it's really a fascinating world, global enterprise with space, with private sector groups and government organizations, given all that, I think what I'm trying to get to here is let's rejoice, but there's some worrisome issues coming up, and I think we got to explore those. And let me get going. Okay. You know, we've got something that NASA has been spending billions and billions on to get back to the moon. It's the Space Launch System. There are critics of this big time. They call the Senate Launch System. You know, there's a lot of money involved in this capability, but they rolled it out to the pad not too long ago, try to fuel this thing up and do a kind of a rehearsal of a first launch of this vehicle. And then they had problems and they had to roll it back. Okay, people get critical of that, but I tell you, I'm old enough to remember the Apollo program, and this is pretty much mirroring what we went through trying to get the Apollo Saturn V rocket off the ground. But this thing's huge. It's big. On top of that is the Orion capsule built by Lockheed Martin, a local company here in Colorado. And, you know, the Artemis program is moving along, and we'll see how well this works. I just as an aside, I just sent somebody that's involved in this program. I said, if this fails, where are we going? You know, what happens next. And that's the exciting part of it. You know, you don't know what's going to really come out of this. But the bottom line is there is so much activity going on. We are definitely on a roll of rebooting the moon. You know, in 1969 to 72, we put 12 humans on the moon through the NASA Apollo program, but it's going to get wild and crazy. There are so many countries now that are involved in lunar exploration. And that's one of the messages of this talk, is that this is no longer a U.S.-owned capability. There's a lot of people willing and raring to go. I wanted to highlight this, and because we're here in Colorado, but one of the next missions, that a robotic mission going to the moon, is Capstone. It's a cislunar CubeSat built by Advanced Space over in Westminster. And there, this is Hickenlooper on the right, getting a briefing on, and that's the size of that spacecraft. It's going to go into a cislunar trajectory launched by Rocket Lab, a private group in New Zealand. And it's probably, I think they're going to be shooting for the next couple of weeks, they're going to launch this thing. But it's going to go into an orbit around the moon that will be important because, let me back up. It'll be important because the NASA Gateway, which is another vehicle that NASA wants to put into cislunar space, will inhabit. And so that this is a very important mission by a very entrepreneurial group located here in Colorado. You're going to see this year alone private lunar operations. You know, this is a private group in Pittsburgh that NASA has contracted with. And that's one of the messages. We have these public-private partnerships, which is hard to say, but it's turning out to be a very innovative idea of bringing the smaller companies to be associated with NASA to do some really important things at lower cost than what the government can provide. Astrobotic is, in, like I said, in Pittsburgh. This lunar lander will, if everything goes to schedule, it'll land this year at the end of the year on the moon. Again, it's a robotic craft with science experiments and a precursor of what's to come. This is what I was talking about. This is the NASA Gateway, what they want in cislunar space. That really is sort of it has been criticized, you know, over the years as a waste of money. To me, it's incremental steps. I mean, NASA itself has not been back to the moon since 1972. The Apollo 17 lunar lander with Jack Schmidt and Eugene Cernan were the last flight to the moon. And we haven't been back. NASA has to get its space legs underneath them. I think this is still a viable concept. Others don't think it is. I think we're going to be lucky if we can afford what this capability may provide for cislunar operations. Now, what you see there is the Orion capsule on the left docked to this facility that transfers people that will eventually go down to the moon's surface. So, you know, we're still talking about 2025, 26, you know, who knows what date it's going to be, but NASA has really broadcast that we're going to have the next two-person crew of Artemis 3 on the moon at that time. And why are we going back? Why do we do this? There's some stuff. I mean, I'm convinced that the moon has not relinquished it's mystery. There is so much stuff that we are going to learn in the next decade by going back to the moon and doing great science with new instrumentation, with the humans on the surface, setting up equipment and going back and forth. And yeah, it's costly, it's expensive, but other countries are also eyeing this same area, the South Pole of the moon, to set up lunar operations. And why do they do that? Turns out that the polar regions have these craters that are never exposed to sunlight. And within those craters, some of the orbiting satellites that we've put around the moon indicate that water ice may be available. And if you have water ice, we're talking ice, and you break that down chemistry-wise, and I was not a good student in chemistry, but you can get oxygen, you can get rocket fuel out of this. The question is how much is down in there, and what quality and quantity is available to actually process. And one of the best things about being in Colorado, we've got the School of Mines down here in Golden, and they have an incredible team of people looking at the prospecting on the moon and using those resources to make this kind of rocket fuel oxygen equation. And again, the bottom line to me is the moon is going to be very surprising. I don't know if it's going to be a positive thing or be a negative thing, but it's going to be surprising. We just really footprinted our way with Apollo, and we're going to get down and dirty on the moon in a much more aggressive capability. This is a kind of an artist, you know, concept. The people that are making the most money on the space program, by the way, are the artists. they can paint some great animations now, and people think, well, is this real? are they on there? No, this is just showing, you know, an Artemis crew post-landing and you know, doing soil samples in the South Pole region. I mentioned, you know, Russia is getting back into the Luna program of surveying the moon, and keep an eye on Russia for a bunch of reasons. Luna 25 is kind of ready to go, supposedly in the next few months, and it's a robotic craft the Russians will launch. It's not clear to me how well this thing's going to work, but this is their reintroduction, Russia, into moon exploration. And they've got good reason, because they're working with China on creating an international lunar research base. And Luna 25 is a kind of one vehicle that will get to the moon. And there's several others that are going to do some pretty sophisticated exploration. But you got to remember, you know, we got all these private sector U.S. companies doing the same thing. So the moon is going to really come into focus here much sharper in the public mind. All these vehicles, India is in there, Japan, there's other countries that are very interested in getting to the moon and doing some early scientific research. So the moon is going to be a kind of a moon-friendly place, and a lot of robotic craft are gone. But on the other hand, we got this guy. I never met this man. I read his emails every morning, and he is a nervous Nelly over there. He runs the Russian space program, Roscosmos. And when Russia invaded Ukraine, a lot of the European, everybody pretty much bailed out of any cooperation with him, including the European Space Agency, which was going to launch this September, this Mars lander rover. And in the background there, you see a little a lander that would deploy this rover, and that was built by Russia. So this is becoming a political a problem for them, and frankly, the Europeans, because they've got to try to figure out how they're going to get that their own robot on Mars. And NASA JPL is apparently working very hard trying to figure with them how to get that rover down there without the Russian involvement. Pretty cool. It's really demonstrates the tension that's global now about space exploration. And that's one of the messages of this talk. Meanwhile, there's always a meanwhile in space exploration because there's so much going on. The Perseverance rover, unbelievable what it's already been able to do. It's landed in February of 2021 in Jezero Crater. The views are spectacular. The rover itself is actually gathering samples to deploy in these little tubes on the surface of Mars that will be collected in future years by a return sample craft. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but Perseverance is just doing great. And here's some, I just downloaded a couple of new ones. I mean, these are the kind of view at Jezero Crater that rover is looking at and driving around. And it could indicate life on Mars. I mean, one of the things they're trying to do at the Jezero Crater site is whether or not water, how much water was there, what are we looking at here, any kinds of past microbial life that formed that the rover might sample and load into those tubes. There's like 36, 40 of them, and that could be returned to Earth in the future in the 2030s. So, you know, things are really bubbling along there. Probably the most adventurous thing of that Perseverance rover mission has been unleashing this helicopter. I mean, this was not supposed to, you know, people were so paranoid about this ability of this helicopter on Mars. It was let loose by the Perseverance rover. It's flown, I think as of today, it's 28 times. And these are the people that made it happen at Jet Propulsion Lab. And that theme is exactly what that helicopter represents. And there it is. It's really been more successful than anybody ever thought. Here's a picture it's taken of its own shadow flying over Mars. And again, 28 times it's flown. It's getting cold on Mars, a little bit worried right now about how its longevity is going to last. But this thing has shown what's possible, because this is probably an early precursor of, if we get humans to Mars, they're going to unleash a lot of these kind of devices. And this helicopter is just an early rotor blade concept. And there's some other new concepts coming that are just staggering what may be possible on Mars. Now we know these devices can fly in that thin Martian atmosphere. You can't forget Curiosity. This thing landed in August of 2012. It's in a different area of Mars doing spectacular research as it climbs up a mountain. And one of the things that the scientists found out is how difficult it is to climb up a mountain with a lot of rubble. And right now they're in pretty dire straits trying to figure out the right path for this rover, which has some wheel problems because the wheels are totally different than Perseverance. So we learned that don't use that design, but because the wheels themselves have been deteriorating, given all the rocky terrain that it's had to climb. But it's doing great stuff. And for my money, you know, we got to keep an eye on, don't forget Curiosity on Mars. It's really actually doing very well. And I think it's going to unload some surprises here not too long from now. Lastly, on Mars, we have the InSight lander. It's a stationary lander. It's doing some incredible seismometry experiments and has just the other day detected one of the largest earthquakes on Mars, which gives you some kind of information about the the core of Mars and how it operates. And surprisingly, I think this last earthquake or Marsquake was something on the order of a I think it's like a 5 on the Richter scale down here. So it was fairly significant. But again, all this data is accumulating and will be useful if humans get to Mars. I mean, all this is going to be part of the package of what we know about Mars at the time of a human Mars landing. I'm going to spend some time on something I'm really want to get out of the public conversation, into the public conversation, and that's China. This is a big story. It may be a sleeper for some people. These people are moving pretty fast. They're creating a space station in low Earth orbit. This is the picture of the last crew that just came down not too long ago, the Shenzhou 13 crew. And they have pretty much set this core facility up to start receiving another set of modules that will increase the size of their space station in low Earth orbit. Just a few days ago, they just launched a supply ship automated that docked with this facility after these people were gone. And these guys are moving fast. This is the story. This is the story of space exploration in other countries. we better pay attention to what they're doing. And we're not, by and large. I don't think it's grabbed onto the public yet. This is sort of a schematic of what, they want to build up there. And it's smaller than the American International Space Station. However, quite capable. And all these modules are going to be docked to this thing this year. They're going to have, you're going to see a kind of a one after another launch of human spacecraft and these labs that are going to be attached to this facility. But they want to do this by the end of the year, 2022. This facility should be up and operating. It's a significant investment by China. And I think it has a diplomatic currency that will kind of make everybody a little bit more awake about how space is important to other countries. China is also has an aggressive lunar exploration program. They've landed on the far side of the moon. They have rovers. This is pictures from the lander showing their own, what do they call it? The Jackrabbit lunar rover. Pretty cool. It's doing some pretty interesting exploration. One of the big things that happened not too long ago with the Chang'e 5, the Chinese landing on the moon, picking up samples of the moon that have not been collected since the Soviet Union did it in 1976. China just pulled this off. They brought back a lot of lunar samples. And here's the vehicle that came back with the technicians unloading the samples. Pretty impressive mission. And what people don't get, as far as I can tell, this whole enterprise was Apollo 11 robotically done. They brought back samples and all automated. And it has all the steps that they need for a human moon landing, which they are planning. And also, what they did here on the moon is mimicking what they want to do at Mars for a return sample program, also in the 2030s, in the same time frame as the US. Okay, next thing, let's see. Yep. And the picture, this is a Chinese drawing of, you know, what they see as a lunar base themselves. Kind of a illustration of what they foresee as a potential lunar base, working with Russia at the point. It's not clear to me how that's going to work, but we'll see if the Chinese and the Russians stay friendly and move together on a lunar moon base. They also have this Mars rover. Just today or yesterday, information from the Zhurong Mars rover on Mars indicated that they have found water, deposits, and how they got there and where they're formed. That's what they're working on. But the Zhurong Mars rover is working very well. And what's impressive with this, this was their first time to try this, and it succeeded. I mean, NASA and other countries have had other problems of trying to get hardware on Mars. These people succeeded on the first go. They have a Mars orbiter, they have the lander now, and they got this rover running around. So it's pretty, again, I don't want to drumbeat too much, but the Chinese, it's a story in action. Let's switch to private sector. I mean, Elon Musk, I know many of you have the Tesla car in the garage, but you know, Elon Musk has just shown leadership in a lot of different ways for returning first stage boosters and landing them on the land. Now it's almost yawnable, but it's still difficult to do. And the guy has proven that you can do it. He has a Starship concept in Texas that they're gonna launch probably sometime this year, depending on the FAA here giving them a thumbs up. But this is unpiloted craft that he has designed that would go into orbit. And NASA has bought into this and actually wants him to utilize this vehicle for a moon capability. So Elon, as always, is a little bit of a mysterious Twitter guy. Owns Twitter now. And he's moving forward on some really progressive concepts that are head spinners, you know, of what he wants to accomplish in the future. This is sort of a SpaceX moon lander concept, but the big picture is Elon, and you know, he's a real believer in a multi-planet species. I mean, he's spending a lot of his money on creating a capability to launch lots of people to Mars for colonization. Very innovative, I'd say, from a trying to be a little bit of a naysayer. There are so many people believing in him. I usually always worry because I don't like the Pied Piper problem. He's got a lot of great ideas, and we'll see how successful he's going to be in the next year or a few years. But there's no doubt that Elon Musk is really leading the pack as far as private ideals about getting to other planets. Similarly, you've got Jeff Bezos, the Amazon.com mogul, which is, you know, billionaires, you know, with rocket ideas. And Jeff Bezos is just pulling off these suborbital rocket flights with passengers. And they just announced another 6-person crew that's going to go up probably later this month, maybe early next month. But, again, the thing about this that's really striking is that I know some of these people that went up personally. I mean, it's just amazing to me that I'm seeing my own colleagues that I've worked with or written articles about going up into suborbital space. But this is a picture of one of them here. This is my good friend, George, that used to run the FAA Space Commerce, Space Transportation Agency. And George had a great time. I just did an interview with him just a couple of weeks ago. He loved it. then you have kind of an outlier here now. This used to be the front runner, but I'd say I'm still trying to figure out where Richard Branson is going to come in on this. He's got a spaceship to orbital capability, and he's flown himself up there. And this is a picture from that one flight. It looks like they're delayed until next year, flying out of New Mexico at the spaceport in New Mexico. And we'll see how Richard Branson handles this in the next few months of what the itinerary really will be for Spaceship Two. But he's pretty strong. And one of his big messages that he even broadcast to the students and general public while he took his flight, seeing the Earth at that altitude, and you get that with Jeff Bezos and the New Shepard. When you look at the Earth from that altitude, there is a mind change that's available. And that's one of the messages from Branson. Got to protect the Earth, learn more about it. And seeing it from up above, you get a much better perspective on that. It's called the overview effect. We've also had, you know, private space pioneers going into orbit, Earth orbit, and being up in the SpaceX Falcon Dragon capsule. These people were all part of a mission on a SpaceX rocket. And, you know, you can't get any better than that. I mean, obviously, that's pretty inspirational for sure. We just had the AX1 flight, another private sector orbital flight. People paid to actually fly in the SpaceX Dragon up into Earth orbit and dock with the International Space Station and stay on board for quite a couple weeks. So we have, you know, what was really amazing to me, and it's, you know, as much as I've written about this, I'm just totally bowled over of how this is all unfolding so fast. Private astronauts up, all these people in the middle there are all the Axiom 1 astronauts that flew on a private mission, and they joined up with the space station, and clearly they got a certificate for being there. The thing that's coming that's going to be really problematic, I don't know what's going to happen here, but the International Space Station, I mean, it's been, being built. There's new modules that are on there from Russia. How long will this stay healthy to be there from a technological standpoint? And actually, one of my friends, a journalist, Alex Witsey, just did a great article in Nature, this thing was launched in 2000, and more than 200 astronauts from 19 different countries have been there. And the question is, are we going to ditch this thing in the ocean, get everybody out of there and, deorbit it? There's a place on the ocean floor called Point Nemo. It could happen in January of 2031, according to WITSE, of bringing this vehicle down. And I'm not a big fan of dumping stuff in the ocean to begin with, and I'm not sure a spacecraft like this should go. I'd rather see it boosted or left where it is, and this could be a great place for space tourism to stop by and say, on your right, out of the porthole, there's the International Space Station. To the left is something else, and so you kind of wonder what the future is going to be. Russia is trying to, this Roscosmos guy that runs that thing, Dmitry, they're claiming that they're going to jerk their modules off and use them for their own new facility in Earth orbit, low Earth orbit. We'll see, again, the political yakking is fierce right now. You have multiple countries or companies now that are really looking at private space station operations, and the technology is available. A lot of people know how to build modules. They know how to assemble them now, mainly because of all the work that went into the International Space Station. So you're going to see more and more of this kind of space hotel type of thinking. And I'm not sure it's not real. Again, the people that make artwork are making the most money so far. And so here's one concept of a space hotel. And there so many people are looking at private facilities in Earth orbit that can be visited by space tourists. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, it's getting much realer. Now, if you believe all that, I got a space elevator to sell you. This is a concept that has been around for quite a while. And who knows what the future of space transportation may be. I still think of rocketry the way we do it today. It's really barnstorming stuff. It's still in the Wright brothers age. Can we have materials that can be used for a space elevator to actually run from the Earth up into orbit around the planet? And I followed these folks for quite a while. I'm a big believer in being surprised, and a lot has happened in composite materials that might make this a reality. A lot of issues, a lot of problems. You got people working on it though, and it could be a 21st century breakthrough to develop a space elevator. So keep your thoughts on that one. The biggest news really in the last few months has just been the James Webb Space Telescope and the unbelievable capability that this thing can provide. Everything looks unbelievably terrific. All the mirror alignment has been done. They're going to start science operations using this. It was launched from Europe. It went to an L point in space, and it's going to be out there to do some really fantastic science and exploration. And again, Ball Aerospace, local company, built the mirrors. And so, again, Colorado's got something to crow about on this project, and we'll see how well it evolves here in the next few months, but it looks very, very exciting of of technology that came together. This is about a $10 billion, I think it's over $10 billion effort. And to be honest with you, I was so, being the journalist, so cynical, I just called this the Just Wait Space Telescope. So we'll, hopefully the wait has been worth the money. A project that's just going to come into your scope of thinking is DART, and it's the first ever mission to investigate and demonstrate a method of asteroid deflection by changing an asteroid's motion in space through a kinetic impactor. And this is coming about in about 5 months from now. This mission is already launched. So we're going to see for the first time whether or not this planetary defense concept is something that can be useful in the future to protect the planet if we see some object coming our way with Earth's name on it. Can we actually move this object? So keep an eye on that. Again, it's about 5 months away when that's going to happen. Clearly the biggest, you know, most fun I've had in writing about space has been the search for life. As we tear up our own planet here and try to figure out the search for life and how to destroy it, we have the gutsy potential to look for life elsewhere. And this is a Europa orbiter, Jupiter. And, you know, it looks to me like everybody is signaling that there's underneath this icy facade of Europa, we may find, detect life. So that's another thing that's on the books and coming up in the future. Okay, now, I got to be realistic. I grew up writing in pretty much space stuff in Washington, D.C. for about 30 years. And this always, I wake up thinking this, where's the money? How much money is the space program worth? What does the public really think about, you know, exploration, whether it's human, robotic, you know, how much money are we going to spend on this? And as you see the inflation problem and all the other issues that you see on the nightly news, somewhere in this, we're going to come to some kind of space crunch. Where's the money? And I don't know how that's going to play out. That's why I left Washington, D.C., because I could never figure it out myself. But people are creative. You know, people, we have so much capability in not only the U.S., but other countries about space exploration. So my guess is we're going to have, you know, some surprises with technology, use of AI, use of more robotics that we never dreamt that we could tackle. And so I think, you know, we're in for a long haul here, to what extent and how fast it's going to go. And again, getting back to the international scene, what diplomatic impact other countries will have on U.S. space policy because of their successes and failure. But, you know, it's all TBD. Whatever the case, you know, we got pioneers that are being baked, you know, today with new kind of concepts, new technologies. Younger people have very important things to this whole role of citizen science has turned out to be one of the attributes. A lot of people are doing complementary astronomy exploration and finding things that professional astronomers haven't. And so we have a whole new generation of space explorers that are coming along with more capability than I've ever seen since the 50s. Another area that I spent a lot of time on, and this is the last couple things, this orbital debris problem. I just listened to a hearing this morning in the House with Perlmutter and some other folks, we got some serious problems. We've had them for a while, but every week, every month that we launch more and more mega satellite constellations and other things, we're going to have to deal with debris removal. So this is a problem. It's becoming more exacerbated by launches by multiple countries, and how we coordinate the space junk. You know, what's up there? Where is it? Is it near me? Will I hit it? We got to come to grips with that, and that's what the hearing was today. Kind of a step forward, but you know, there's going to be multiple steps needed, and they got to be done now. Last couple things. It's the Are We Alone? And I don't think that question is the right one now. Are We Alone is the kind of thing you write as a journalist late at night when you can't think anymore. And you just say, are we alone? Time will tell. Well, time is telling us that we're not alone. The question is, how crowded is it? And I think we're on the precipice of some significant new revelations that will surprise and shock the public, maybe. One of the things that's in the background of all this is a whole new kind of UFO, kind of mind drama. And that's unidentified aerial phenomenon. And nobody knows what these vehicles are. And they've been highlighted by a lot of UFO groups and all that. But this has gotten so serious that next week on Tuesday, there is an actual congressional hearing on this, on these phenomena. And I don't know where it's going to go. It's an open and closed hearing, but it's next Tuesday, and you'll be hearing about whatever people are going to say about the validity of all this, and whether you're a Roswell believer and the aliens have already crashed here. We'll see where we're going on this, but it's pretty interesting, and it gets back to the Are We Alone phenomena. So are they real? I don't know. We'll see. In the end, I think I'm quitting here. People ask me, what do I think? I think that's me. I don't know everything about where we're headed. There's so many potential short circuits and money problems and policy issues and Congress and where's the money, and it's going to be a little bit of a roll your dice thing, but we've come a long way in 50, 60 years about space exploration, and I don't see us squandering that legacy that we've had. There's so much open territory ahead of us, and the technology looks ready to go. I think the wherewithal within NASA and other countries around the globe, space is going to be here with us. Exploring space is going to be here for the long haul. And where that takes us, I don't know. But any questions?
I think everybody can unmute now. Wow, I'm still stuck on not are we alone, but how crowded is it? So everybody, please feel free to show your video. So we've had some questions. I'm going to go ahead and I'll start at the last one, and we can work our way up. And please feel free to either put your raised hand icon up or type some questions in the chat. I think we can all agree we're probably all stunned with all the information we're absorbing right now. Thank you so much, Leonard.
I'm stunned too.
Sorry?
I'm stunned too.
Putting
this together, I realize how much is going on, and you should see what I chopped out.
Yeah, I believe it. So with regards to resources, are we as humans putting too many resources towards space exploration and travel when we have so many issues on Earth that need addressing? Elon Musk would like to move humans to Mars when Earth has become uninhabitable. Shouldn't our main concern be to save our current planet rather than trying to terraform another? Love your views on that one, or anybody else that wants to jump in.
Yeah, I'm with that question. That's a good one. It's just yin and yang thing. You know, we have, again, a legacy of space exploration for so long. I don't feel we're going to squander that, but I think the ethics involved with space will become more central. And I think, you know, saving the planet Earth as a launch pad is probably a step one. You got to have a healthy planet for people to actually think about migrating away from Earth to another world. But it's a great question, and it has dogged the space program since day one. Why spend money on space when we got all these problems down here?
I've always thought that they don't have to be exclusive. Like, I know this was a big, these questions were huge in the civil rights era.
Yeah.
I can't help feeling myself like you can do both, but I don't know. Anybody else? Any thoughts?
I just wanted to say, I do believe that space exploration is super important, and a lot of our greatest technologies and advances in technology has come from our space programs. But I also feel like people are looking away from Earth and what is provided to get to this point. And they just think, we can just run off to Mars when we destroy our planet and everything will be fine. We have another one close by. And just sort of disregarding what Earth has provided for us and everything. And, you know, only the ultra wealthy can afford space tourism and leaving Earth. So where does that leave the rest of us when Earth is been stripped of everything?
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a train of thought that, you know, and the National Academies, quite a number of groups have looked at geoengineering down here on Earth. You know, can we actually control the sun and help our climate in some way? And the tools that we could do to do that seem to me pretty similar to what terraforming suggests at Mars. But you know, who has, you know, Earth, you know, Mars 101, or you know, whatever, you know, fooling with the environment of Mars, it can be done. But you know, I think you're right on. It's just, you know, you're not going to be able to go anywhere unless you keep our planet in some intact way. But the geoengineering side seems to indicate that we can actually manipulate the climate. Now, whether that's a good thing or bad, I don't know. But there's a lot of work going on now about geoengineering. So it's another topic I keep an eye on.
Can you define that a little more? Do you mean like things like cloud, you know, seeping and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's really changing the sun.
Dyson sphere.
Yeah, its impact on the atmosphere. And also, you know, I, a long time ago, I did an article for space.com on taking the twist out of Twister. It's my favorite title.
That's a great title.
Yeah, well, there are things that we are doing down here with microwaves and defense capability. I just this morning, I looked at a new weapon system. You know, we don't need to have tornadoes on Earth. I mean, we can get rid of those things. You can take out the power of a tornado. You know, we're going to have to get onto that. I'm a big believer in that. I think we can control the weather much more than we do and just let it rampage us. So I think that's another area. But again, that's terraforming on Earth. And how do we do that responsibly? And you know, we don't use it as a weapon. against other countries somehow. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm kind of going off track there.
No, it's very interesting.
Hey, Electra, I'd like to add a little different viewpoint.
Of course. You know,
the question was phrased that I think it's a binary choice, space or Earth, right? And I think you pointed out we could do either. I would point out that there is a point of space exploration where we have to do space exploration to save the Earth. If we do not, it will doom the Earth in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, we talked about the DART program, you know, of threats that could be there. You know, right. We're essentially focused on the threat that humans are placing to Earth. But there are many other threats there that we're, I think, ignorant of. And I think exploring space is the only way that we can get out there and see what's going on. So, you know, that's my two cents. Humans have been explorers.
Yeah.
From the dawn of our civilization, or what we are. And it may be the death of us too, by the way.
Yeah.
And the other thing that a lot of people don't know is that the NASA budget is less than 1% of the whole national budget.
Yeah.
You know, and the military budget.
I'd cut the defense way more and put it to NASA and the environment than, you know, do it the other way.
I didn't really get into this because I don't want to dwell too much on personal things, but I think one of the problems I see right now in the military space activity, you've got air, land, sea, polar. Every place that we can get to, we've got military conflict, and space is the new domain, and it's not even low Earth orbit. I mean, we're moving into cislunar, and even the moon. And I'm not blaming the Space Force or whatever. I'm just saying that we're seeing a domain of space becoming more militarized and weaponized. God knows what's really happening up there in a classified world, but we're just on the edge of losing another domain to warfare that could be striking putting a match to a fuse that leads down here. And so, I'm pretty paranoid about that. And that's happening as we speak. It's just one day after another, there's a bunch of new capability that military operations, not just by NASA or Space Force or whatever. We're seeing a whole domain becoming weaponized.
Leonard, could you talk a little bit about how NASA funding is doing? You know, what are the policy and where's the push with that? Some insights into that.
Yeah, I mean, overall, NASA's doing okay. You got Bill Nelson, the former senator running the NASA show, and he's done a pretty capable job. You know, I've talked to him on the phone here not too long ago, and the budgets are pretty stable and strong for NASA, but the Artemis program to go back to the moon is a really money soaker and trying to get the space launch system off the ground. And so we're seeing a fairly healthy NASA right now, but I just, you know, I'm just cynical enough after DC experience being there, you know, things can change and all of a sudden programs get cut off. I mean, even the Mars Return Sample Program, it's huge. Billions of dollars, and it's going to cascade into probably more money. I can't remember what the number is now for that damn thing, but it's a very expensive, and it just cuts into a lot of other programs. So trying to do this great balancing act within NASA to keep space exploration, whether it's asteroids or Mars or Europa, or, you know, keeping all these other programs alive and well, it's really a kind of a juggling act. That
Leonard, we had two people touching on the question of Ukraine, Russians jamming GPS and commsats in Ukraine, so space warfare seems to exist, and also the question of with Russia's attacks in Ukraine, with their military capabilities, do you think they're also going to have capabilities for their space programs? If you could talk about that, that'd be great.
Well, I'm not up on everything. You know, some of it's probably classified things that the Space Force is going through now. But I do know that jamming of satellites, there's been talk of optical blinding of satellite sensors with lasers from the Earth. And then you have the threat of anti-satellites, which is fairly, that's a big deal. When you start blowing up somebody's satellite on purpose, then we are into a kind of a war situation. And, you know, again, the U.S., India, Russia, China, they're all guilty of doing these anti-satellite tests. So, and that just contributes to the overall space debris population that is harmful to other satellites that are doing, you know, direct TV and, you know, communications for public and run the ATM system for your banks. And it's pretty serious stuff. So I'm not an expert on that, but I just flag it as something I'm really worried about. The military.
All right, you're giving me nightmares. We're going to like move.
Yeah. On the positive side.
Any sweet moon dreams. What about, we know the Chinese have been landing on the dark side of the moon. Do you think there is something on the far side that could be used?
Yeah, I never call it the dark side. It's got light 14 days. You know, it has sunlight back there. The far side is can be lit up pretty big. Yeah, the Chinese are working on the far side with their U-2 rover and finding some interesting things. You know, everybody to a country is now looking at the South Pole of the moon. And this is going to be, as I think I had that one slide, looking at permanent shadowed craters that might have water ice that you can use to sustain kind of a living off the land philosophy, which is what everybody is going to have to do. You don't want to haul all that material and water from the earth all the time. Can you sustain yourself at the moon? And that to me is the biggest question mark right now about where we're headed. And everybody's going to the South Pole, and there are certain areas of the moon that are much more strategic to be in than other parts. So this is, I'm not talking land grab, but something's coming. And you know, we got issues when the lawyers are there already.
Oh, that's funny. All right, some other questions, maybe some things that we feel we're excited about that are gonna bring some good things to humanity and the rest of us.
I'm curious, Leonard, what you think of Starlink? When you think of, you know, you mentioned the mega constellation that are right. Going up, and then I can't remember of the like 1,300 total launches of satellites that have been in the total history of space. SpaceX has like over 40% of them or something like that because of all the satellites they've put up.
Well, certainly, you know, I think he's launching tomorrow another set of those damn things, 57 or whatever it is. Yeah, and he's popping these things up. And I try to monitor the astronomical observatories, and, you know, they're paranoid, you know, they're pretty, and they're making their views known at the UN. And, you know, I don't know, you know, and you, it's not just Starlink. Amazon's got a whole cadre of these satellites they want to launch. And there's some other ones. China's got a whole set they want to put up there. And, you know, after a while, you're just like, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the Starlink things. It's pretty surprising. I mean, people see them go by and they think UFOs. I mean, they're all on a line. And Yeah, so the astronomy community is in lockstep, I think, overall, about trying to flag the fact that these satellites are damaging their astronomical capabilities. And but again, it's not just Starlink. You got to add up what people are talking about. We're talking thousands and thousands of satellites. It's a big number.
Yeah, OneWeb and stuff. You know, Electra started up.
Exactly.
Some positive, you know, like we're in a very rural area.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we're all on the internet, but then my background is a network engineer, so I'm used to much higher bandwidths. And one of the things that Starlink does is gives access to very remote regions, high-speed internet. And then I know, Electra, you wanted to go past the Ukraine thing, but I don't know.
No. Whatever you guys are interested in.
But one of the things that was very, I'll say, impressive of, I'll say, American creativity is that Russia was jamming Starlink in Ukraine. And I think in 3 days, Starlink implemented a code switch and then are doing multi-band switching across a whole broad spectrum with their phased array that basically just put down the whole jamming and stuff. And so Ukraine was back in working order. Anecdotally, the U.S. Military was very interested in that. And it's like, what? You had self-healing technology? Let us talk.
Yeah, I know. They were pretty impressed with the ability. I think General Raymond, who runs the Space Force, was very impressed with their Starlink, you know, exercise there, and was somewhat embarrassed, I guess, for the military. They can't do it as fast. So, yeah, there's some lessons learned there. But, you know, it's just one of these, you know, from the astronomical side of the picture, I just don't know where it's going to go. When you add up, like you said, OneWeb and you do the Amazon, you do Starlink, that's a lot of satellites. And, you know, okay, how are we going to handle this in the future? I don't know.
It's just Leonard, do you think private companies have too much freedom launching satellites? And, you know, these billionaires and major corporations are just kind of willy-nilly doing whatever they want in space.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I think when the Tesla flew toward Mars, I was worried. I'm not sure. You know, you don't want to be too negative about the private sector because NASA is embedded with these folks now and doing a lot of really good work with the private sector. And there's a lot of capability. It's less expensive. It's faster. You raised a good point. I don't know. I'm not going to go either way there, but you just wonder, you know, what, you know, the bad thing that happens, I've seen this in DC when I was there. You know, when you stifle innovation, it turns ugly there. You know, you try to regulate people and you try to tamp them down somehow, and it usually turns against you somewhere down the road. So you really kind of like the creativity level of a lot of private sector. You know, since we've been talking here, probably 5 new rocket companies got started. I mean, you know, that's how fast things are going. I mean, you know, people I can't even keep, I get all these emails every morning from company I never heard of. You know, they're just startups and they have entrepreneurial money and the people, there's a whole Dylan Taylor and, you know, he's an entrepreneur. There are a lot of people investing in a lot of these companies. So there's a lot of unleashed intellectual capability that we're seeing here. But yeah, is there a need to regulate? And that's what this hearing this morning was trying to tackle. You know, how do we regulate these people and not cripple everybody?
How does the space community view Elon Musk?
I don't know. My view is that it's a little bit of a Pied Piper problem. I love the guy and I met him, and he's an incredible visionary. But, you know, there is a problem here with everybody jumping on board too soon. The Starship is just an amazing vehicle of what he's trying to conceptualize there. But it hasn't flown yet into orbit, and we'll see how well it does. I mean, he likes explosions, that's for sure. I mean, his whole history has been explode, fix it, explode, fix it again, then it works, you know. And so he's got the money to keep this bandwagon going. But I'm a little, you know, and I want to be wrong. I don't. The Pied Piper problem is, you know, everybody wants to believe they're going to jump on a Starship and go to Mars and live there. And okay, there's some people that want to do that, but you got to fly and buy, and we'll see how he does. But, you know, he's certainly with us, you know, this whole concept of bringing back the booster stage and landing. Wow. What a story. I mean,
can you talk more about that a little bit for those of us? Because I kind of know, and
everybody's seen this stuff. I mean, my God, he's got drone ships. The booster comes back, lands on the drone ships, or lands on the land at Vandenberg and in the LA area, or Santa Monica, or whatever, you know. But, you know, he's proven something that people kept talking about, and he did it. I mean, people have been talking about this for a long time. Can you recover these first stages and reuse them? And some of these things have flown 19 times. I don't know, you know, whatever it is. He's recovering the shrouds off the vehicle, the nose cones. So, you know, he said what he was going to do, and he did it. And you can't fault him for that. So, and, you know, frankly, China's trying to mirror what he's done. Other countries now are, you know, into the game of reusable rocketry. You know, it's a little bit of the classic syndrome you find with, you know, if you flew a plane from the East Coast to the West and then you just trashed the plane. You know, we got to get to some kind of economic viability here, where it's not a big deal to fly into space and use the vehicle over and over again. That's where we're going. That's where we're going. We're still in Wright Brothers phase, but we're going.
Leonard, you know, in my mind, what you kind of hit on the point that is the big difference between like the government-sponsored SLS system versus the private systems and how they approach design and the ultimate, I would say, overall package. And then the thing I would point out, you start out the SLS system. I've lost track of the billions of dollars spent on that system.
It's so has NASA.
and then when you think of it, it started out as, in my mind, a way to employ engineers. There's a limited number of parts that were manufactured in the 60s that we don't even have the manufacturing techniques anymore to be able to make. So there's a limited number of these that we can actually put up. And it's like six, assuming they all get assembled correctly, right? Yeah. And then, you know, you compare and contrast it to, you know, we've been picking on Elon Musk, but then, you know, there's also Rocketdyne, you know, and then what they're doing is they're building rockets in more what I would consider the Silicon Valley fashion.
Right.
You build it, you blow it up, you know, and then you learn from that, and then you go from there. And it's an iterative design, the software, you know, realm. They call that a waterfall method or a continuous improvement method and stuff. And then, you know, you mentioned the Chinese and other people are looking at that. And then whether or not you like Elon Musk or not, you know, one of the things that, at least in my mind, that he did when you looked at the Starship is he looked at it as a holistic design. Right. You know, and then the thing I would point at is stainless steel. Right.
Yeah.
You know, at one point it was carbon fiber. You know, and they did all this manufacturing for carbon fiber, but then okay, we're doing it for lightweight. We're trying to optimize for lightweight, but then we have this other problem. It's got to come in, you know, the atmosphere at a tremendously high rate, and it's got to burn off all that speed. So we need something that essentially can be heat tolerant. Oh, wait, carbon fiber breaks down at around 400 degrees Fahrenheit, yeah. Whereas yeah. stainless steel has a temperature of over 2000, right? And then yeah. when you start factoring all these things in, you know, if you look at the whole cost of the vehicle, Starship becomes much more economically viable. And, yeah. and it really took, you know, somebody to look at it top down in my mind, as opposed to, well, I've got to build the Orion capsule and here's my part. And then here's my specifications that I've got to plug into the Orion capsule on, you know, my booster module here, right? And then that's somebody else's problem, right? And then, yeah. you know, everybody keeps on kicking down the can down the road. And all of a sudden we realize, hey, wait, we got to raise the tower for the SLS, what, 10 meters? And by the way, it's going to cost you $1.2 yeah. billion to be yeah. able to do that. Oh, my freaking God.
Yeah.
You know, how often can we do that? You know, so.
Well, that's
I'll shut up now.
That's great.
All great points. You know, it's just but it's you know, I'd rather be where we are, you know, right now, and this dynamic situation of the private sector moving forward, government opting. NASA's done pretty well on these private public partnerships. You know, they see the writing on the wall. My good friend Lori Garver, I used to work for her. She's got a new book coming out, I think next month. It's kind of I can't remember the name of it now, but I've read it. It's great. But she really points to the whole conversion of NASA into the using the private sector much more actively, and some of the scary turns and that has happened over the last few years. And so we're on something good. Rocket Lab is another one in New Zealand. I never met the guy that runs it, but they're on a roll there. And actually, just today, I just saw some new stuff that they're going to do private sector Venus exploration. You know, they got you know, money from some company or whatever. And, you know, this is a whole nother realm of exploration of the private sector. They can do that. And the other thing that's going on, I spent a lot of time on Mars, but, you know, there's no way we can do Mars return sample at billions and billions of dollars and not get some kind of low-cost Mars missions underway. And that's happening. There's some new, really clever ideas about exploring Mars that through helicopters and some other devices, but you know, that's coming along. So you're right. I mean, there is something going on here that's gonna not catch us by surprise, but because it's a bit evolving, but it's a good signal. It's a good signal. And I hope the money is there to support some of these folks.
Does anybody have any last questions? I feel so privileged to be a fly on the wall in this incredibly smart conversation with all of you.
I'd just like to compliment you, Electra, you know, for organizing this. It was a great talk.
Well, and I think clearly we're going to have to keep having Leonard come back because things are evolving at a very fast rate. Any other questions?
Yeah, well, Leonard, I just wanted to say one thing about, I think it was Ben mentioned, which I didn't know. I knew that the Starlink satellites are getting dimmer with the new designs, but he says most astronomy is done with stacking of data and the passage of satellites is screened out as noise. So that's, I didn't, you know, I know they stack and, but I didn't know they could screen out the satellites. So that's good news.
That's encouraging, and I hope Elon Musk pays for that.
Yeah. go ahead.
No, and also,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to mention I posted on the chat earlier on there, Leonard and I run the Skywatchers, Coal Creek Canyon Skywatchers, not far from Ned and Nederland, and two of our members are on here. I put my email in there if you want to get the, we only send one a month, you know, but if you wanted to hear about our next meetings, probably our next one would be the first week in June. And then also to definitely don't miss the lunar eclipse this Sunday, because it isn't at 2 o'clock in the morning. It starts at around 8. So yeah, that's Sunday, this coming Sunday, and there are details there and one link, but you'll hear it on the news. And we're getting emails about, you know, Fisk Planetarium is doing a night if it's clear enough. You can go down there and watch it with them, and they'll have their telescopes out. And there's also a video forward to the moon that one of the CU professors helped produce that's really good and goes into more detail with some of the things Leonard was talking about with the moon bases. And there are two other new messages.
Just remind everybody that we do have free passes to Fisk and also the Mountain Peak Life. Remember the North of 50s. We're also going to be doing some trips to Fisk. Well, thank you so much. I really want to just thank everyone for everybody's time. Yeah. And Leonard and Barbara are very responsive. So if you have some questions that you didn't get a chance to ask, if you want to send them my way, I will for sure pass them on.
Yeah, thanks so much for listening to me ramble on.
You did not ramble on. It was incredibly interesting.
Well, you know, I don't get a chance to think too much about what I think, you know, and these kind of associations with other people about the space program are really unique and dynamic for me and makes me think more. So I appreciate everybody listening to me go on the deep end in outer space.
Well, I think we're going to do a dinner next time when y'all are ready to come on out, because I can do this for 3 hours with some drinks or maybe four.
Okay.
Yeah, a coming out party for us.
Yeah.
We're kind of careful. I just wanted to say, too, though, that, let's see, Lauren asked about Skywatchers. It's free. We're all on Zoom. If we go back to meeting at the Coal Creek Canyon Community Hall across from United Power on Coal Creek Canyon on 72, we usually ask for donations just to cover renting the hall, but we're probably going to be on Zoom for a while longer. And everyone's invited. There's no real membership. And we've been with Zoom, we've been able to pull in experts from the West and East Coast. And last time, a couple weeks ago, we had planetary defense. Leonard mentioned some of that. We had the head of that, the two people who head it from NASA headquarters, and they're the top running over, or, you know, they're the head of about 20 people who work for them. So we've just had some amazing speakers and some local people too, which we'll get back to. We've got a lot of great local people who've given presentations. Anyway, yeah, just wanted to say. And plus, if you get the Mountain Messenger, we've got an article in there every month. But I don't know if that's delivered so much in NED.
Well, I'm going to have to get it at the library. So trust me, it's coming. Yeah, definitely. I didn't know about that.
Come to the library.
Yeah, I'm going to pick that up. Well, again, thank you, everyone. And moon pies are on the library. Swing on
by.
We love
our libraries.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. Have a good evening. And I think we'll all be doing some watching this weekend. All right. Take care.
Keep looking
Thank you.